Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. And our guest this evening is Stephen Myers. His website is www.thepump.org. And we're going to talk about the Great Pyramid and how it was built. So let me welcome Stephen to the show. Stephen, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me on your show.
I'm glad to have you, sir, and I have a co-host who's going to also help me out a little bit with the interview, Daniel Cooper. So, Daniel, just jump
hello.
In anytime you like. Feel free.
Yeah,
to
hello.
Well, hi, Daniel.
I'm just testing it. Hello. I'm just testing my new microphone thing here, so hope it works.
Sounds good.
Great.
Stephen,
all right.
Stephen, why don't you start out and tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, and just from a high level also let the listeners know your theory on how the Great Pyramid was actually built.
Okay. Well, my name is Stephen Myers, and besides this pyramid stuff, I'm actually rather normal, so... That's good to know. I am interested in how the Great Pyramid was assembled and how the original builders used it. And I've written two books on those two subjects. So I contend that the Great Pyramid was assembled using water locks similar to those in the Erie Canal. And they used water lock technology and allowed the stones that are on barges to be moved from the Nile River all the way up to the building site. And if you will, imagine the first stones set in place were the casing stones, and those stones are bonded together watertight. And if you fill that area up, it would be like a square pond up on the Giza Plateau. They brought stones on barges through the water locks all the way up into that pond and set from the barges the stones for that level right into the pond, if you will, the interior stones. And when all the stones were in that pond, then the first level of the Great Pyramid was completed. And that process continued level by level, first the casing stones of each level and then the interior stones until the Great Pyramid was completed. And I think that the purpose of the Great Pyramid was that it was built to be infrastructure for the civilization that built it. And that infrastructure was a working machine, and it served as a massive, industrially scaled water pump.
So, when did you...
Go ahead, sorry.
Stephen, when did you get the idea that water locks were used to bring the stones all the way from the quarry? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the quarries, many of them were on the other side of the river. So all researchers, Egyptologists, contend that the original builders put the stones on barges, at least to get them across the river. But I contend that the original builders were geniuses and used water locks to move those stones right to the building site. That was an idea that was originally conceived of by a fellow named Edward Kunkel, and he wrote a book about that called Pharaoh's Pump. And I read all the books like Egyptologists have written about a big ramp and sweaty backs and all of that stuff. but none of that made sense. Certainly Egyptology hasn't demonstrated any of that. And I finally read this privately published book by Edward Kunkel, and that was a very, very good book in terms of the technical requirements to build the Great Pyramid. So then we just furthered that research and ultimately wrote two books myself.
Daniel, did you have a question?
Yeah, no, I think it's pretty cool. I've been watching some neat things on the pyramids. I guess I don't know if you agree with his work, but Brian Forrester, he likes to go on all those sites. And what I find interesting, too, is you see all those big shafts that just go to nowhere, and you would think that they'd probably be used for water. Have you ever looked into the cave or whatever that was found that went underneath the pyramid? Because there was some group of people that did actually get into it. And I guess that Hawass guy, I forget his first name, did finally acknowledge. Sorry?
Certainly. Yeah. Right. His name was Zuhi Hawass, and he did some going into various caves on the Giza Plateau. There's certainly a lot of shafts and caves and excavations all around the Giza Plateau area where the Great Pyramid is over there in Egypt. And different explanations are available for those different shafts. Some, believe it or not, have standing water in them. So I find that quite fascinating. But and then around the Great Pyramid, there are some excavations, some precision cut, fairly large and deep holes in the ground, I guess you would call them. So yes, there's a lot of excavations in that area.
That's pretty fascinating. I was wondering. Would it correspond, I suppose, with a time when there would have been more water in that area, or what would you theorize on that?
Well, basically, I discuss or am interested in how the Great Pyramid was assembled and also why it was assembled. My research doesn't address when it was assembled, but certainly a long time ago, possibly before the last catastrophe, that's up to quite a bit of speculation as to when the Great Pyramid was assembled. But our research is more on the process used to move the big heavy stones from point A to point B and that type of thing. So, yes, later, if you go much earlier than what traditional Egyptologists say is the construction date of the Great Pyramid, it is not as much a desert. It's more of a savanna or more a water in the area. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because when you look at the Sphinx, I guess, too, you can see all the erosion from the water, and it has to be at least a minimum of 10,000 years old, I guess, to look at the geology.
There is a lot of erosion on the Sphinx. That's true. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. And to see all the blocks that they carved out, the huge blocks, I guess, to get rid of out of that area, and they put them kind of not far from the Sphinx, I guess. And would that kind of fit in with what you're talking about, too? Because I'm actually interested in hearing what your theory is in more detail. I love the subject.
Well, great. Yeah, everybody seems to love the pyramids. But, yes, the stones we think were moved not by people worshiping crystals or humming or contemplating their navels or using a magic wand. We think that real people in the real world actually moved very heavy objects. And a very good way to do that is with water locks. In the Erie Canal, when it was first built, it was 4.5 feet deep, and the barges carried a capacity of 70 tons. Which is the weight of the heaviest stones of the Great Pyramid. And water locks, people say, oh, it can't be water locks. It's got to be something like from the aliens or whatever. Well, here in the 21st century, water locks are the 21st century system of choice to move our heaviest objects. The Panama Canal is just expanded, and they use bigger water locks because that's the best system that we have to move heavy objects.
Fascinating. So how does it work exactly? What can you describe what a water lock, how it functions a little bit?
Yeah, certainly. There's a lot of YouTube videos and that type of thing. But it's if you have two canals, let's say, that are of a different level, you have a water lock, which has doors on both ends, and a ship will move in to the water lock when the water is low in the water lock. They shut both doors on both ends, so it's kind of an enclosure, and they simply add water to the water lock, and it raises it up to the next level or the higher level for the canal. And the Erie Canal, from one end to the other, moves barges higher than the height of the Great Pyramid. So it's quite interesting. You know, it's a elegant and simple but quite sophisticated method of moving heavy payloads, and it's also quite fast.
And would this work also?
Much faster than Egyptologists. Egyptologists have never moved a payload the size of the largest stones of the Great Pyramid, 1 inch. The entire science has never done it.
Right. Yeah, it's funny when you hear a lot of the researchers or historians, they don't usually consult engineers when they're coming up with their theories.
They also do not engage. Egyptology is the only science that does not engage in the scientific method. I mean, they can put forth a hypothesis, but then that's not science. A hypothesis
right.
should be proven through demonstration. Never do that in Egyptology. That's like against the rules.
Isn't that
so
weird,
It's very strange when you really look into it. Very strange.
Do you have any thoughts on that, Mark?
Well, it seems even science is starting to kind of go that way. It's kind of like, how would you prove certain theories like black holes, for example? That would be kind of...
Yeah, black holes, string theory, and all of that. I mean, that's great. And you can have mental experiments for those types of things. But we're talking moving a heavy payload. And Egyptology doesn't do it. An Abrams A1 tank weighs about 70 tons. And, you know, just grab one of them, drag it through the sand... and drag it up a ramp that's bigger than the Great Pyramid itself, and there you go. But Egyptology has never moved a heavy payload around the corner of a spiral ramp. They've never moved this one on or off of a barge.
Would this method work also for...
Move,
oh, go ahead. Go ahead, sorry.
There's... Egyptology has never moved two stones in 4 minutes. It's never been done. As many cows have jumped over the moon as stones Egyptologists have moved in a authentic manner.
Right.
What they will do, not to harp on Egyptology, but what they will do is they'll move a massive 1.5-ton stone and then say, that's how 70-ton stones were moved.
Yeah.
Isn't that strange? You know, there's a scalability issue. Did you know that I can pick up a car? I can go right outside and pick up a car. And I can prove it to you by picking up a Hot Wheels car. Not a very good demonstration.
and
that's
even
the type of thing we're dealing with Egyptologists. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, and there's...
Here in the 21st century, you can go to college and get a degree in Egyptology and still think that precision stone cutting was accomplished using hand tools. They've never done that. They've never made a surface of one casing stone in the manner they say it was done all day long.
Yeah,
bizarre.
It's amazing. And there's some even bigger stones, too, like not perhaps in the pyramids themselves, but around the pyramids, like the statues, I guess it's in different parts of. I don't have a map in my head of where all these areas are, but there's some that are like
thousands. About.
So,
and also the Sphinx enclosure has some very large stones too, but Egyptology is no help in understanding what's going on, what happened in ancient Egypt. In fact, Egyptology is detrimental to understanding what really happened.
Seems like they're covering something.
It's also interesting how much of our history is intentionally covered up. At least it appears to be that way.
It seems so. I mean, they can't be, like Egyptologists can't be that deluded to think that you can accomplish precision stone cutting on a massive scale using hand tools. I mean, they can't be that dumb.
Especially with the hardness
the real
of the
world.
Stone that you're talking about. The hardness
bizarre.
Of the stone
alone. It's strange.
Because when you look at the hardness of the stone, a lot of it is above the 7 on the Mohs scale of hardness, which would require diamond cutting tools. So I'm pretty sure they didn't have that in Egyptology.
No, they just used bronze chisels and Doriite pounders to achieve precision stone cutting, but we won't demonstrate how it was done. That's Egyptology.
Yeah.
It's strange. So, I mean, we're in a revolution of ideas, of thoughts and everything, and the old ideas are going away. The old ideas that pyramids were granaries, which was very popular in the Middle Ages. Even a presidential candidate here in the United States said that the pyramids were granaries. That was Dr. Carson, believe it or not. But those ideas are going away. People aren't accepting that. And they're not accepting that it's a great big tomb that doesn't look like a tomb. People are kind of going towards that the Great Pyramid served some purpose. It had a function. It actually did something. There was a return on the huge investment that was expended to make the thing. It wasn't just symbolic or religious or anything like that. So that's a trend that is happening right now, that the Great Pyramid, with all of its precision, was some sort of a machine that they gave back dividends to the people who built it.
So, Stephen, are you saying that they built basically something like a canal from the quarry in Aswan? Isn't that Aswan about 500 miles away?
Sure. They quarried the stones 500 miles away. Everyone agrees with that. They put those 70-ton stones on barges. Everybody agrees with that. Those barges went down the Nile River to the catch basin in the Nile, close to the Great Pyramid. There was an additional canal with water locks from the catch basin all the way up to the building site. Those stones on barges were moved effortlessly and moved up through the series of water locks up to the building site.
How far was the catch basin to the actual pyramid?
There is scholarly debate about that, but it doesn't matter. It's water locks and barges and canals. You know, it's like saying how far away is the Lake Erie from New York City? Doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. They built a canal between the two. Actually, the position of the Nile River is under scholarly debate. It has changed course over the eons. Some say it was even on the other side of the Great Pyramid at one time. So, you know, it's hard to say exactly where it was. But the original builders, who were geniuses, built a canal from the Nile River all the way up to the building site.
I've been in a few locks with my father and on his boat. And I don't remember that much, but you kind of go into this stone area, and you're usually at a lower water level than the river or the lake that you're coming to. And then they fill the lock up with water, and the boat raises up, and then they open the entrance, and you can just kind of drive on out.
Yes,
but I never really understood all of the engineering involved of all that. I've never really researched it at all, and how they do all that. You know what I'm saying? I'm not really clear on how all that works.
But it's a system that can lift battleships.
Yeah,
and in a controllable manner. And it's in effect, because it's raising heavy weights, it's a anti-gravity machine, if you want to call it that, because it's counteracts gravity in a way, you know, whatever term you want to use. But it's water locks are what people that actually have to do something, that's the system they use. You know, that's why Egyptologists, they don't have to do anything. They just tell their stories, so they don't really have to do anything. But that's why they built the Erie Canal at a huge cost, but it was a tremendous return on investment. Same with the Panama Canal and other canal systems. So it's fascinating. There's a lot of evidence for water on the Giza Plateau. The casing stones that were on the outside of the Great Pyramid were bonded together watertight, with a bonding agent stronger than the stone itself. Flanders Petrie found Nile earth inside the Great Pyramid. That's sediment, if you will. Herodotus described the Great Pyramid as being like a island surrounded by water. And there was a wall around the Great Pyramid that enclosed a pond, is our interpretation. So there's a lot of information about water concerning the Great Pyramid.
That's very interesting.
I guess if somebody wanted to use it, say, like in a great flood or something like that, it might be a good place to hide out if it was a water pump. What do you think?
Well, I think that it was purpose-built to be specifically a water pump. You know, like a hydroelectric dam only does one thing. It moves little electrons along a wire. That's what a hydroelectric dam does. But you can use that for many, many, many purposes. And I believe that the pumped water was used for many purposes as well, including irrigation, of course, but also used for powering heavy machinery, for creating a vacuum, if you will, and also compressed air. And even the compressed air could be used to make high voltage static electricity and a whole host of things. I see the Giza Plateau more as an industrial park than some sort of a funeral home.
Well, you see evidence of the machining all over those stones. Like, what I'm so blown away by is you can actually measure, like, the boreholes, how much pressure was actually, or how much the cutting tool was able to cut through this, you know, really hard granite that no copper chisel could ever touch, you know, and it was going through the stuff faster than we can do it today. So
yeah, it's very high rate of feed. That is correct.
Yeah. It's fascinating. So the evidence is all over those stones. You can see the saw marks absolutely everywhere. So it's not a secret. So for anybody
that's for
engineers,
sure,
or whatever.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of high technology associated with the Great Pyramid. And I wrote a book. My first book is titled "The Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid," and it describes how the Great Pyramid was assembled. And it's available as a Kindle ebook or in softcover.
Right on. And did you ever hear about, I you can actually go on Google Earth and you can put in the speed of light, and I think that's the longitude, and that gets you right to the center of the pyramid, which is, I find kind of funny. I always love that little fact.
It's interesting. That's true for whatever it's worth, but it's kind of a correlation between those two things, but there's no real evidence to indicate a causation or that it was intended. It's just
right.
Like two data points that have been cherry-picked and compared, if you will. So I'm kind of dubious about a lot of that pulling facts and figures out of a hat and then comparing them without any causal relationship.
Right. But I guess they did have some knowledge about advanced mathematics and so forth. And
I'm sure they were smart, but there's no evidence that they were comparing the speed of light and the coordinates of the Great Pyramid. A person
right.
could say they were comparing the coordinates of the Great Pyramid with the number of days in a year and got it wrong. That's just
right.
just as valid as you know, coming up with a correlation without causation. So, but yeah,
right.
there's a lot of different ways to look at the Great Pyramid, and various qualities of research techniques have been used to come up with things.
So
did
they have a kind of a crane that they used to put the stones on the boats?
I believe that they used specialized barges that were built for specific purposes to do different types of things. For example, they would have, let's say, a stone was already on a barge and they wanted to move it off of a barge. So they could move the barge between two stands, if you will, made out of stone. And the barges, I think, were rather narrow. And the stone that they were taking off of the barge was wider than the barge. So if they moved the stone between those two supports and then let water enter the barge, it would lower the stone onto the supports. And then they could move the half-submerged barge out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very easy method to remove a stone from a barge. But then from there, they had other very specialized barges to do different tasks to manipulate and set in place these massive stones. I have a video series on our website that shows all of those procedures in detail, all the way up to placing the capstone, and that's at thepump.org, so they can see all how casing stones were moved, how the largest stones were moved, how the ceiling stones of the Great Pyramid, the ceiling stones of the King's Chamber were moved and set in place. So I hope people watch our video series and get a greater understanding of the details of the entire process.
Yeah, I went to it. That's www.thepump.org, right? Yeah,
yes.
I went there and saw some of the videos. They're pretty interesting, but I don't remember exactly how the stones got on the barges, though.
Yeah, the focus of our research is how the Great Pyramid was assembled. We don't go into the quarrying aspects or the stone cutting. Those are still lost technologies. But the process for moving the stones from the quarry onto the barge would be very similar to moving the stone off of the barge, if you will. They probably had an area that had water in it for the barge, and a barge would be half filled with water, let's say, and the stone would be on supports. So they move the barge under that stone and then remove the water from the barge, and it would raise up and the stone would be on the barge, if you will. But it's a very versatile and powerful system to use barges, specialized barges, the buoyancy of water, and to move and set in place these stones.
Very
like, why not, right? So, yeah, it is pretty cool.
Now, you said you were talking about the last catastrophe. Are you a person that has a point of view that there was a great cataclysm roughly 12,000 years ago?
There was probably something happened, I'm sure. Could be the biblical flood, could be an ice age, could be something. But I just pointed that out as a possibility of when the Great Pyramid was built. But, you know, let's say we found out when the Great Pyramid was built. Let's say it was, I'm just going to pick a number, 20,000 years ago from today is the date that they started it. Okay? Mm-hmm. Let's say we figured that out, absolutely know it. Well, then what? Then you wonder, well, how did they build it? And why did they build it? So I don't focus on when it was built very much. I know several researchers who have spent their whole lives trying to find out when it was built, but when they do, I mean, what will we really know? Also, who built it? Everyone wants to know who built the Great Pyramid, even if it was built, you know, a long time ago before the age of the pharaohs. Let's say it was somebody named Bob. Bob built it. Now we know who built it. It was Bob. Well, the very next question is, well, how did he build it? And why? Why did he do it? So those are the two things I focus on. Not so much mm-hmm. as when, but or who, but how and why.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that's fair, because how and why, you know, the more we understand that, probably the more we're going to understand about, you know, all the other questions eventually too. So it's probably a good place to start.
Certainly. But also, I think that knowing how and why will help us in our modern but very troubled world. You know, we'll, if we can use this, the ancient lost technology, to redevelop some sort of system to pump water cheaply, then we'll have an alternative to nuclear power or an alternative to fossil fuel generated electricity. Even an alternative to hydroelectric dams. And, you know, you don't need a great big pyramid, just a smaller custom-built structure, mainly the passages and chambers made out of PVC pipe and polypropylene containers, and decentralized the production of energy. And it's a clean, energy-efficient method, and I think that it would be very important to redevelop that technology. Our website is the website for our nonprofit foundation called the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation. So if anyone is interested in that, finding out what we're about, what we're doing, what our mission statement is, they can go to our website and find out those things and even send us an email if they would like.
You know, I think there, there's,
go ahead.
I think that there is, what is it, 2,300,000 stones were
that's
used
an
in the
estimate.
Great Pyramid.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it depends on on the base of the Great Pyramid. It's not flat all the way across the base. There is it's built on a mound, if you will, and it depends on the size of the mound. But yeah, there's quite a few stones. To build the Great Pyramid, it's a big structure to say the least.
And
it's eight sided too. It's eight sided too, so I mean it's not like, and you can barely see that little detail, but when you look closely, it's eight sided. So why would they do that?
Oh, well, we think during construction it impounded a pond, if you will. I talked about that pond earlier. And the hydrostatic force of that pond would push out on the walls of the pond, if you will. So if you have a crease on each of the four sides and have each side, in effect, bend in, it would put the walls, the force of the water inside would put the walls in compression. And it would be a way to make the Great Pyramid even stronger during construction. So that's my book talks about that in great detail.
Right on. Go ahead,
so
Mark. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, that's all right. So the Great Pyramid was a water pump, is what you're saying, right?
That is correct.
And did they use it to help with irrigation?
Oh, I would think so. Certainly. I would. They would use the pumped water for just a whole host of purposes, but let's say for irrigation. The largest and most expensive structure in North America, when built, the most expensive was the Grand Coulee Dam, and it is used to irrigate much of eastern Washington. It's on the Columbia River, so that dam has pumps built right inside of it. And those pumps pump water up higher than the dam into a large depression, if you will, a coulee. So in modern times, we built a huge structure used to pump water. And in ancient times, in the Valley of the Nile, they built a big structure to pump water. They operate differently, but they're both very large water pumps.
And why do you call the Great Pyramid the Great Prosperity Machine?
Oh, that's easy. It's the same reason why they built the Grand Coulee Dam or even the Aswan Dam. They built this Aswan Dam, or the Great Pyramid, in the middle of the Valley of the Nile. And the Aswan Dam was built at a great cost, but it had a huge, huge return on investment. It provided prosperity for those people that built it. The Aswan Dam, it provided irrigation. It generated electricity. It did a whole host of things. The Aswan Dam turned empty stomachs into full stomachs. The Aswan Dam transformed the desert into a garden. The Aswan Dam provided prosperity for the people that built it and was a huge return on investment. The same as with the Great Pyramid. They built it to transform the desert into a garden, to turn toil into leisure. Isn't that nice? To transform poverty into prosperity. That's what the Great Pyramid did for the people. It wasn't something symbolic to point to something. It wasn't to put a pharaoh's carcass in. It wasn't for that. It was to help people. You know, it was an active, functioning machine that actually helped the geniuses who built it. With the huge return on investment of the pumped water. So the Grand Coulee Dam, the Aswan Dam, even the Great Pyramid were all built for the same reason. They provided prosperity for those who built it. Nobody would build a Aswan Dam to tell people in the future that they knew what pi was or even the speed of light. Could you imagine? Hey, we want
right.
to tell people 10,000 years from now what the speed of light is. Well, let's build this great big Aswan Dam, and then they'll know that we knew. So anyway, that's why I think it's a prosperity machine.
Yeah, actually, I was watching a documentary recently on the Sahara Desert, and they were saying that actually every 20,000 years or so, it does actually turn back into like a lush, green, beautiful place. And I guess there seems to be some sort of a pattern there when they looked into the geology of the place and the life forms and so forth in the fossils and so forth, and finding whale bones, you know, way out in the middle of the desert, you know, this kind of thing, that are actually not that old, and it's pretty fascinating.
It is.
I think there might, you know, if they were going to build it, they would probably want to build it in a time when it was, you know, a lush green place already, because they would certainly need lots of resources already there. Instead of having to bring them in from somewhere else. So it's, you know, that could point to some other kind of theory there too. So.
Well, it's interesting to contemplate, that's for sure, exactly when it was built. But again, our focus is on how it was built. But yes, I think that it would improve the lives of those who built it. And that was the motivation for its construction.
For sure.
Nothing to do with religion, nothing to do with the pharaoh, nothing to do with, you know, symbolism or any of that thing. You know, real people moved real stones in the real world, and for a real purpose. And that's what the focus of our research is that type of thing.
This actually brings up an interesting question I have, because when you look at a lot of the building sites in South America, for example, where they do use similar stone techniques, where you actually see the boreholes and the saw cuts and all that sort of thing, and they're way up high in the mountains. Would this theory, would that kind of play into that as well, or do you think they would have to use a different method in those places? Because a lot of those stones are fairly huge as well.
There are some big stones that have been moved. But again, the focus of my research is how a single construction project was built. There could have been similar technologies in South America, that type of thing. But I don't think that every pyramid may or may not have been built on Earth in the same manner. Some use 80-pound sun-dried bricks. And probably you can move 80-pound sun-dried bricks in a different manner than you would move a 70-ton payload.
Yeah.
So
well, I guess,
there's
I guess
also
even, even...
many pyramids that are quite primitive, and they may have been built in a different manner. So.
Yeah, it's fascinating because I guess when you look at a lot of the South American and even actually in Egypt in many cases, you see that the really good stone cutting techniques are built underneath. And then it seems like all the really half, you know, half crap jobs with the mud between the stones, and the stones aren't really nicely cut. They're usually just broken or, you know, that sort of thing, are on top of these really perfect constructions. So you would think it would be the other way around because, you know, the technology improves over time, not decreases. So it's fascinating, I think. And,
yeah, that's the idea of uniformitarianism, where, you know, we started out in the Stone Age and cave dwellers, and then it got better and better and better. But the evidence certainly doesn't support that idea, more so
right.
of a catastrophe that destroyed a high civilization. And then afterwards, there was a much lower quality workmanship for you know,
right.
a different civilization. So, yeah. So it's strange. I know that as much about understanding, let's say, even just the Great Pyramid, we have to unlearn much of what we've already learned and have to transcend our presuppositions about knuckle draggers and a big ramp and all of that. So it's a difficult task to unlearn something even more so than to learn it. So it's a battle to try and go beyond those things.
It's pretty hard to deny that Bob the Builder was a pretty impressive guy. So
yeah.
I'm kidding.
that's true. So it's but really it's interesting. I mean, there's just a new understanding going on, a revolution of thought, going away from Egyptology's explanation of pyramids to something quite different, something much more technical. Any 45-story skyscraper, which the Great Pyramid is a technological marvel. It's twice as tall as the first skyscrapers built, let's say, in the United States. The Flatiron Building was 22 stories. And it was considered
wow.
one of the first skyscrapers. So it is a phenomenal structure. In effect, you know, 99% solid, if you will. So just like a hydroelectric dam is. So it's quite a structure and quite a machine.
Right. Yeah. So I was just wondering, you know, those shafts that point out towards the stars in the pyramids. Not that I'm bringing stars into this again, but you know, they go up at a 45-degree angle. Some of the shafts that they
kind
put
of.
Little those little drones that they put in, not drones, but little remote control cars and things that just to look around and
mm-hmm.
see what was in there
mm-hmm.
and all that sort of stuff. And I guess in some cases they found some sort of a residue of certain chemicals that would have the only real explanation we would be able to think of is certain kind of power generation going on, actually changing the chemistry of the stone, or leaving some sort of a residue in these places that would not really be explained by conventional Egyptology as well. So it seems like that would maybe fit into, you know, a hydroelectric sort of purpose in that sense. Have you ever heard of those things?
Yeah, I've heard of them. The King's Chamber has two vents that are on opposite walls, and the Queen's Chamber also has two vents. And some people have different scholarly debate about the purpose of those vents. Some consider that they point to the specific stars, but because of the precession of the equinoxes, or the grand precession, if you'd rather call it that, they don't point to those stars. Those passages don't point to the stars that all those pictures on the internet show them pointing to. They point to different stars. But other researchers think that maybe chemicals were introduced into the Great Pyramid from the outside through those vents. But I think that the King's Chamber vents were used specifically for the output of the Great Pyramid water pump. So the input was at the upper end of the descending passage, and the two King's Chamber vents were the output of the Great Pyramid water pump.
Fascinating. And is there any evidence in your mind about some of the talk that goes around about the use of harmonics or whatever? It's not something I know much about, but I've heard about it on certain videos and so on. So I just wonder if you've run into that at all.
Well, certainly some people think that there was some sound or sonic levitation, that type of thing. There's videos on the internet of moving grains of sand or water drops with sound acoustic levitation, if you will. But even to move a piece of sand or water takes a huge amount of energy, and how that would be scaled up to move 70-ton payloads is not understood by anyone at this point in time. But people see a grain of sand being moved, and they think, oh, yeah, that's how it was done. So that's my thought about any type of harmonics or sound or whatever inside the Great Pyramid. But, again, I think that the real people in the real world move the stones in a real way, and we see the result of their work over there at the Giza Plateau.
Certainly, yeah. No, I think it's fascinating. What do you think, Mark?
Stephen, what are your thoughts on the Queen's Chamber? What was the purpose of that area?
The Queen's Chamber was used in the pumping process. We think that there was a vacuum that was created in the Grand Gallery, and that vacuum drew water up into the Grand Gallery. And then some valves were opened and closed, if you will, automatically, and that big water piston, which probably weighed 200 tons or more, moved down, and that compressed, that moved water into the Queen's Chamber, and then compressed the air in the upper half of the Queen's Chamber. So that's what that was used for. And then ultimately, water moved into the King's Chamber and then out the King's Chamber vents. My second book, The Great Pyramid Prosperity Machine, describes how the Great Pyramid operated as a water pump in detail. So if people are interested in that process, how the passages and chambers have a functional explanation to pump water, then certainly I hope they read my second book.
So it was all about pumping water out of the river, I guess, and then into areas where they could grow crops or whatever.
Essentially, it was about pumping water for a whole host of uses, yes. And the water was probably there's scholarly debate how water got to the building site, but we think it was from the ancient Lake Maurice, if you will. And that process, again, is described in my book. But, yeah, they built that great big thing just to elevate water, if you will, you know, move it farther away from the center of the earth. That's called pumping water. And that's all it did, a single-purpose device. But the uses of the water for so many things, like I say, provided prosperity for those who built it.
Well, that's very interesting. So you kind of have it as a very down-to-earth, practical thing that was just pumping water, and that's pretty much was its whole purpose.
I do. Just like the people that built the Aswan Dam, it's a practical thing, and all it does is, it actually does several things. One of them is flood control, but all it does is make little electrons move in a wire. The Aswan Dam has no ornamentation. You know, it has no mummy in it. It has no writing inside and out that's ceremonial, if you will, just like the Great Pyramid, just like the engine in your car. It doesn't have any writing inside the cylinders. You know why? It's a machine. It don't need writing inside of it. It's the same with the Great Pyramid. Everything, all the temples and the obelisks, they got writing all over them. You know, everywhere, all on the columns, on the ceiling, and all in the tombs. Great Pyramid, no, doesn't need any writing. You know, why would you write on a water pump? So... It's a real thing that was really, really done. It has nothing to do with religion, has nothing to do with language even. You know, it was moved by people just like us, maybe quite a bit smarter. And those people had a goal in mind, and they determined a way to reach that goal. And that goal was a big goal. You know, they wanted their children to eat every day, and they achieved that goal, and that's what the Great Pyramid was about. We think it used some rather unusual technologies to pump water, and our nonprofit foundation is dedicated to redeveloping that ancient lost technology to help us in our modern but very troubled world.
So, Stephen, tell us about your books again and your website and anything else you kind of want to plug or kind of finish off the show with here.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be on your show. My first book is Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid, and my second book is The Great Pyramid Prosperity Machine. Both are available from Amazon.com in softcover or Kindle ebook, so that's kind of nice. And then our website is at thepump.org. And it'll answer a lot of your questions, and you can email us if you have additional questions. Our current fundraising effort is we are using crowdfunding to acquire a 3D printer for our facility out here in Oregon. And we're about halfway there. So if somebody wants to be involved in helping us get a 3D printer, they can certainly, you know, take up that opportunity. And so that's all donations are tax deductible because we're a 501c3 nonprofit. And if they have more questions, just send us an email from our website.
Last question. Can you tell us about some of these other lost technologies?
Oh, certainly. Real quick. Well, I mentioned they had developed some sort of a bonding agent between the casing stones. That bonding agent is stronger than the stones itself, and certainly made them watertight. There's controversy as to what that bonding agent is. That is a specific lost technology of the Great Pyramid. Another one is the stone cutting methods. The casing stones on the outside were very, very precisely cut. And how that was done is not fully understood in modern times. Certainly no one has demonstrated a method to make that precision stone cutting that would be consistent with what technology Egyptologists say that the ancient Egyptians had. So that's a lost technology. Water locks is a lost technology in that what is lost is the understanding that it was used, water locks were used, to build the Great Pyramid. So that's another lost technology. So, and then some technologies associated with how the Great Pyramid operated as a water pump. So those are some of the lost technologies. And, of course, that is what my book is about.
Very cool.
Well, I think I better stop there. I could go on with some more questions, but we're kind of running out of time. Stephen, thanks a ton for coming on. It's been very, very interesting chatting with you. And I like the fact that you kind of have a down-to-earth perspective on this whole thing, which is kind of refreshing.
I appreciate that. A lot of people are drawn to our research just because of that. And then they see our video series or read the books and they say that the explanation for how the Great Pyramid was assembled is compelling, is the word I hear every day. And that it makes sense and that it's logical and it's doable. So I hope people just find out what we're about and then contemplate the direction of our research.
All right, Stephen, have a great evening. Thanks for coming on the show. Daniel, thanks for joining me. And we'll see
You're
everyone probably tomorrow. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
Bye now.